Okay, I think I can start now. And obviously by this time we're getting into the middle of the meditation retreat. And I hopefully by now that many of you have overcome your sloth and torpor, or a lot of your sleepiness anyway, by having rested. So your body and mind are just ready to go deeper in meditation. This is a meditation retreat. And in a meditation retreat that I try and organize things, encourage, inspire and teach, so you can not just talk or think or conceptualize about letting go, but you can experience it, experience the wonder, the incredible peace and joy which happen when you start to let go of things, when things start to disappear. So today I wanted to give almost like I think what we called it some years ago, like a travelogue of what happens when you meditate. Because sometimes people in interviews, they say, oh, this happened and that happened, was this okay, am I on the right track? And it's helpful to know that you are on the right track. It's helpful to know what's happening and why it's happening and everything's okay. And even though you don't have any expectations, you know what comes before, you know what's coming next, sort of. To give you like an overview of the whole path of meditation. And of course, this is not just based on my own personal experience. This is based on the teachings of the Buddha. When I was a very young monk, being taught a bit of this and a bit of that, it was not really all that consistent. But you had a great teacher, Ajahn Chah, who taught you how to let go. And I remember this one occasion, and this is something you can do, a little technique, if you haven't done this already. If so far in this retreat you still haven't been able to let go of your problems at home, your family, your business, your health, you can do the sit exercise. Because one day, just coming back from arms round, Ajahn Chah picked up a stick and he turned around to me and said, Brahma Wangso, is the stick heavy? And before I could answer, he threw it away. Much further than that, but I've got to get that later on. He threw it way into the forest. And he said, it's only heavy when you hold on to it. And of course, you've got the message there. Your family, is that heavy? Only if you hold on to it. Your finances, is that heavy? Only if you hold on to it. Your business, is that heavy? Only when you hold on to it. So what you can do with the stick exercise, after the talk, you can go into the forest and find yourself a stick. And, if you get a little pen, you can write on the stick, take the bark off, write on the stick, husband. And take it as far as you can into the forest. Wife, kids, boss at work. If you're an abbot, you write monastery, monks. If you're on the committee of the Buddhist Society, PSWA committee. So you can totally, because when you throw it away like that, a physical exercise, it does have a psychological impact to it. Because what your body does, your mind tends to follow. So you learn how to just let go of these things. So you had a great teacher like that who taught you some amazing things which you could do so easily. And if you're a Thai, red shirts, yellow shirts, write it on a stick and throw it as far as you can into the forest. So you don't worry about these things during the retreat. You worry about them when you go home. But not when you're here, so you throw it in the forest. So that's how you can let go while you're here, because this is retreat time. Retreat means we leave all the business of our world. There's no way you can be still and peaceful if you carry around all that sort of stuff in your head. This is a time when you need to stand back, have some peace. So when you go back to that husband, that boss, that Buddhist society, that politics, whatever you get back to, you can actually have a much better perspective. And that means you're much wiser, more compassionate, and more effective to doing good things in the world. But first of all, we've got to sort of stand back. And that's why that we had a great teacher telling you how to let go. And this is what I've been doing so far during this retreat. And sometimes people have said, well, you're not teaching us meditation. Aren't we supposed to watch the breath or do metta and just may all sentient beings be happy and well? And what is the chant? What am I supposed to do? But of course, I've been teaching retreats for a long time now. This is all on purpose. Because I don't teach you how to meditate, because if I did, then you'll do meditation and you'll get nowhere. You'll do the meditation rather than letting meditation happen. And too often that people try that path. Yeah, they seem to get a little way, but I like to give the simile of the maze. If any of you have gone to these, the hedge mazes, which they have in many parts of the world, the hedges, these bushes, are higher than you can see, so you can't actually get an overview of the plan of what's happening. So you just have to trust your luck, go left here, go right there, and to try and get into the centre. And it's a path, it seems to be getting into the centre, and so you go so far, and then you find, no, there's a big hedge between you and the middle. And so what do? You can't try force your way through the hedge. That's just cheating. You've got to go all the way back again and try it on the right path. Because the right path, it might go all the way around this way and that way, but eventually it leads to the centre. That's the right path. And that's like different ways of meditation. Sometimes you try one particular method of meditation, and this is, I'm talking about like striving. Okay, sit down, close your eyes, back straight. Watch your breath, or else. And I, or one of my monks, comes behind you with a big stick. And if you nod. I went to a monastery like that when I was young. Because, this was in UK, weren't any monasteries at all around. So there's a Zen monastery opened up and said, well, they're doing a retreat, I'll go there. I saw Buddhism was Buddhism. But on Saturday morning, you had to be there about 4 o'clock. And it was really cold, so you had your blankets on, and you didn't have much sleep, because you were in dormitories where everyone was snoring, except me. And they said I was snoring. You never think that you're snoring. Yes, you are. So, I was really quite sleepy, but I always had good luck. I had good karma in my life, because the person sitting next to me was nodding more than I was. So he got hit first. Whack! And of course, it didn't hit me. I didn't feel any pain, but as soon as I heard that whack, I was dead straight. I was not sleepy at all. No way was I going to be sleepy. It's amazing just how fear can overcome sloth and torpor. But that wasn't really good. That was just tension, and that was just the wrong way of doing things. To get people to meditate out of fear is not the way. You understand that fear is a very unwholesome and unskillful state of mind. That's like going down one way of the maze, which it can get you so far. Yeah, you can be straight, you can get rid of sloth and torpor, but you can't have that looseness, that peace, that joy which gets you into the deep meditations. You can get so far and that's it. And it's the same with effort which comes from you, because you see, this is what I've got to attain. I've only got a few days left. This is very hard to get on these retreats with Ajahn Brahm. You don't know whether I'll be able to get on one again, so I better make the most of this. So okay, no messing about. Mind, you watch the breath. And I've done those meditations before, and you just, again, screw your mind up. You can get onto the breath, and you can watch the breath maybe for a whole hour. You've got this incredible tension afterwards, this tightness. And I've known many people, actually the first time I came across this was when I started going to Malaysia, which was very strong in the Vipassana tradition, which was really asking people to struggle. And that's when I first heard the term Samadhi headache. And it was really amazing. What do you mean, samadhi headache? Sort of, samadhi meditation. Meditation gets rid of headaches. It doesn't create them. But oh, no. In the many people over there, they were getting samadhi headaches. Then, you ask yourself, why? What are they doing? They're holding themselves so tight. And of course that's going to cause you a headache. And of course no one gets samadhi headaches here. Because this is another path. That path can lead to where you can get some sustained attention on the breath for long periods of time, but it's not pleasant. It was one of the incidents of my early life. There was a French monk who was just a bit junior to me, 1 year, he would end 1 year after me. And whenever he would meditate, you would never see, his head droop. He had perfect posture. And, we would stay up all night sometimes, once a week. And we'd get up early in the morning. And other monks like me, I was nodding. He was perfectly straight. He would hardly talk to anybody. And, you know, when we were sort of talking to one another, we thought, well, that monk has really got something. He must have some great samadhi to be able to hold his body straight that long. He must be such a wonderful monk. He doesn't need to be so restless and talk to others. And after 3 years, he disrobed. I couldn't believe it. He's got such good meditation. How come he's disrobing? And then he led on. He told other people. He started talking about what was going on. He said he held his body so tight all the time. He said it was so much tension and struggle just to fight. And you know, he managed to endure that for 3 years. He said after 3 years I just couldn't stand it any longer. Just the tightness, the effort, the stress was just too much for me. And he said sometimes, you know, in the early morning meditation, he'd open his eyes. He said, I look at you, Brahma Wangsa, and I see you just with your head drooping down, half asleep. And I was so jealous. I thought, if only I could do that. And that really hit me, because that was a person I had grown up with as a young monk. And you saw the pain in his mind, because he just could not let go. He was so proud that he had to be straight. Because, you know, it's embarrassing, you know, if you're sort of a troop, isn't it? You think, is somebody watching me? Has Ajahn Brahm got a camera so I can catch you on camera? When your head is down. There's nothing wrong with that. And of course that story, one of the crucial stories which I love telling people, because it fits here. This is the path of letting go. Yeah, you do get sloth and torpor sometimes, but also you get deep meditation. And you eventually get enlightenment. This was the case of the Buddha with his attendant Ananda just walking through the forest. And there on the edge of the forest he saw a monk sitting with the perfect posture, back straight, right hand over the left hand, eyes down, thumb slightly touching, perfect. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda, I'm worried about that guy. 2 weeks later he disrobed and got married. The Buddha was right. But the same day in another part of the forest, he saw a monk who was nodding this way and nodding that way. I have to do this because otherwise I'd nod in the microphone. And sloppy posture, you know, hands all over the place, back bent. And the Buddha turned to Ananda and smiled. I'm not worried about that monk. 2 weeks later, he was enlightened with all the psychic powers. So, if I see any of you nodding this way, nodding that way, 2 weeks later. Now, of course, those stories you like repeating because they're what we call counterintuitive. You know, that we've got this idea of perfect posture means you're much closer to enlightenment, you're going to get somewhere. And when you're slack and nodding all over the place, I mean, that's a hopeless meditator, they'll get nowhere. And the Buddha knew different. And the reason is that first monk was the control freak, controlling his body. He wasn't letting go, he was actually holding himself. He was grasping. He hadn't thrown away the stick, he was holding it so tightly. Whereas that second monk, he learned how to let go. Sure, when you let go, as I said, putting the grass down, as soon as you put it down, the water moves more than ever before. But then it starts slowing down. It's only a matter of time. Please remember that. It's a very important story. So this path of letting go, yes, you go all around the maze, but then eventually you start going right to the center, and that is a path which actually leads to the center of the maze, which gets to jhanas. Because otherwise you get so tight, when it gets, you can get so fight, sometimes you can even get to the nimitta stage. But the nimitta is just so harsh, it can't have that softness and that beauty and that brilliance to take you further. You come across the brick wall, the hedge wall, you can't go any further. When you go to this letting go way, it's amazing just how it works. For those of you who think, what if I let go, mind's going to go all over the place. If I let go, the mind will wander here and think here and do all this sort of stuff, I better hold on to something. No. There's a great simile of the bird on the tree. Sometimes, before I heard this from somebody, I always wondered how it was that birds, when they go to sleep at night on the branches and twigs of a tree, never fall off in their sleep. Some of you may roll out of bed, and it's, you know, it's just a wide bed. Imagine a bird just with its claws, you know, just on a tree. How on earth can it get any rest at night? Especially if it's a windy night, the tree's swaying this way and that way. What would you do if you were standing on a tree at night, you were up there all night, to be able to stay on? You'd grab on as tightly as you could. But that's so much tension. How can a bird have a good night's sleep? And the way is that this is the nature, the anatomy of a bird's feet and claws, whatever you call it. The more it relaxes, the more the claws close up. It relaxes more and the grip gets tighter. The more it lets go, the more stable it is. That's the nature of the bird's claws. So when they wake up in the morning, the natural state of the bird is actually to be tied onto the tree. It has to put some more effort. It has to do something to actually open up and release itself. And that's actually how the birds stay on at night. The more they relax, the faster and deeper sleep they have on that tree, the safer they are. Just like you. The more you let go, the more still you will be. The more you'll be able to stay in your meditation object. Because if you do something, you wander off. If you let go, it's like the claws of the mind close up on the meditation object, and the mind doesn't go anywhere. That's also the nature of the mind. Counterintuitive, just like it's counterintuitive to think how a bird has to relax to close its claws. But that's the way it works, and that's the way your mind works. So when you start walking that path of letting go, you come across all these amazing states. And this is why the Buddha described like stages of meditation. Why I describe stages of meditation in books such as, you know, the Basic Method of Meditation? Because people like stages of meditation. You've grown up with stages of meditation. You go to school, you go to grade 1, and then grade 2, and then grade 3, and grade 4. And on that story, one of my favorite monks in Thailand a long time ago, when he went to grade 1, after 12 months or 9 months in grade 1, he failed. Now that really takes something to fail grade 1. I'm not quite sure, maybe he couldn't hold the crayon the right way. Or, and I used to do plasticine when I was in grade 1, maybe he couldn't do plasticine, I don't know. How can you fail grade 1? I don't know, but he did. So all his friends went on to grade 2. He had to repeat grade 1. And the second year, he flunked again. And with the best will in the world, the teacher just could not send him off into grade 2. So he repeated grade 1 the third time. And when he failed grade 1 the third time, that was it. It was just out of school. He was hopeless. He was untrainable. He was not intelligent enough to even go to school and grow to even pass grade 1. Now that really takes something. You know, if you think you're dumb and stupid, imagine somebody like that. Grade 1 3 times fails. So what do you do with someone who's that stupid in the villages in Thailand? Because they realize that, you know, he won't know one end from another of a water buffalo. So how could he actually use a plough? He'd be hopeless farming. So they thought, there's only one place they can send such a stupid young man. To the monastery, that's right. To making him a monk. So not all monks are like that. So there he went to be a monk in a monastery. You know, even these village monasteries, I know sometimes you can be very critical of, you know, monks in a village or this, and they sort of, you know, have money and they may have TVs and stuff, but you know, some of them are very, very kind people. Yeah, they may not sort of keep the rules like, you know, the forest monks keep the rules, but there's a certain kindness to them which is very beautiful to see. And this particular monk, you know, he was very, very kind, and he spent so much time with this young man trying to teach him the chanting. Namo tassa. What was the next word? Tassa. Oh yeah, tassa. Namo. What was it again? So he couldn't even do namo tassa. And after 2 or 3 years in the village monastery, you know, even the abbot just gave up on him. And so there was one final resort, the last place they send such hopeless, useless, dumb, stupid, untrainable people. And that was the forest monastery. In the forest monastery, you don't have to study so much. We don't do so much chanting. Even the chanting we do in the morning, that's nothing like the chanting they do in some of these other monasteries. You know, in the Sri Lankan tradition, sometimes you chant all night. You know, it's amazing. What do you do that for? Just no one's listening after 5 minutes. They've all got their head down there or looking at their blackberries or whatever, I don't know. But anyhow, that we keep it nice and simple. This is a forest monastery. They didn't need to do any chanting. So, what happened at the forest monastery? They do meditation, so. The teacher there just taught him how to meditate. Just watch your breath go in and out. And it was so easy. His mind was just so simple. He soon got into jhana, soon became an arahant, one of the great monks of Thailand. Totally enlightened. Wow, the trouble with you is you're too clever. Yes, so I'll give you all lobotomies or something. So anyway, that was a wonderful case of just, because his mind was very simple, he could follow the instructions, he could let go, just let go, he would let go. And sometimes you guys let go. How we let go? What are we supposed to let go? What do you mean by letting go? Now, do we have to let go here, or do we have to let go when we go home? And how can you let go when you've got a job and you've got a kid? And, you know, do I need to really let go right now? Because my other teacher told me I'm supposed to watch the breath. So, his was so simple. He just let go, just let go. And he didn't need to be told all the instructions. But sometimes that we give people instructions because, you know, you are intelligent, poor things. So, you really do need have something just to trick your intelligence into letting go. So that's why we say all these words about contentment and just be at peace and blah, blah, blah. And so why we also have these stages of meditation. But now, first of all those stages of meditation, you know, whether it's stage 1, 2, 3, 4, or the 16 stages of the Anapanasati or whatever, the first important thing to know is the next stage is always within the stage you're on now. It's not anywhere else. So to get to stage 2, you have to solidify stage 1. And then you find the mind goes into it. Into its center, if you like. And there you find stage 2. And as you're with stage 2, that sort of solidifies, it stabilizes. And then you find your mind goes in to stage 3. And then from stage 3 it goes into stage 4. Even the jhanas, the second jhana is right in the middle of the first jhana. Third is in the middle of the second. Fourth is in the middle of the third. Right in the middle of all of those things is enlightenment. So it's always going in. Now that's an important thing to get in your heads, because many people think you have to go on to the next stage. So I'm going to let go of this stage, which I'm on now, stage 1, so I can move on to stage 2. To get from this room into the walking meditation hall, you have to leave this room to go to the meditation hall, and then from the walking hall you have to leave to go to the toilet. Now, from the toilet you have to leave to go to the dining room. But imagine a room where you had sort of your bedroom. In the middle of the bedroom was a dining room. In the middle of the dining room was your toilet. In the middle of the toilet was the sitting meditation room. In the middle of the sitting meditation room was the walking meditation room. All concentric. And that's very much like what meditation is. You don't abandon this stage. You don't say, all right, I finished this one, now I'm going to do something else. No, stay where you are. And you go into it. You go into the deeper state of meditation when you're ready. You cannot rush this. It just happens naturally. So that's the way I meditate. Sometimes I get up early in the morning, I'm sleepy, I'm restless. I stay with that sleepiness. Because I know the next stage of meditation is right in the middle of sleepiness. So to me, hindrances are just starting points. They're not things to get rid of. They're starting points. It's just where I am right now. And I know just the way to get into the middle of that sleepiness where the beautiful mind is. It's just to be peaceful, not to do anything. Maybe just, you know, like you get up early in the morning and still there's too many fighters in this room, too many soldiers, thinking that if you have an enemy, you've got to beat them up and destroy them. That's not the way of Buddhism. Buddhism is a pacifist path. We don't fight, we don't destroy. We learn how to live with things and transcend them. So you're with your sloth and torpor, don't fight. And then it just disappears. That's what happens. When I was in Thailand, we would get up at say 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night we'd go to bed. You know, four and a half hours was my average sleep sort of in Thailand when I was there. And you know, you were told only 4 hours. I did 4.5. I felt very guilty. I got an extra half hour. But now I know that's not enough for a human being. 4.5 hours sleep. So in the morning I was sleepy. Why? It wasn't because I was weak. It was because I was sleep deprived. It was natural. I was on this terrible diet of rice and whatever crawled on the ground. Beetles, ants eggs, frogs, you name it, I've eaten it. That's about right, you know. First thing I was told by the other monks, don't ask what's in the curry. They said that, because if you found out, you know, you'd be sick. So, cows after birth, placenta. Have you ever had that? That's actually, if you're vegetarian, that's quite okay. Because, you know, when a buffalo gives birth, the placenta there, it's not harming anybody, that's just waste product. So that's one meat a vegetarian should be able to eat. I wouldn't recommend it though, because it's disgusting. So there's the stuff, and there was hardly any protein in there at all, so you're always really thin and weak. So there I was, malnourished, sleep deprived, and of course, you know, I was born in London. Now this was the hot jungles of northeast Thailand. There was many more trees there than, you know, these days. So it was very thick and humid and hot and close. When I look back upon it, anybody, if the Buddha had been born in England, he would have fallen asleep in the tropical climates. Simply because it's nature, that's all. So I look back upon that and just, of course you fall asleep in the morning if that's all the conditions and causes, but me, stupid, fight. So I decided to fight my sloth and torpor. And we had all these tricks which we used to do. One of the tricks was to get like a sewing needle and put it between your thumbs. Because when you fall asleep, ow! You prick yourself. And that was actually a stupid thing to do. The more interesting one was the matchbox technique. So you get a matchbox, and then you take the cover off, and you put the matchbox, you know, the tray, with all the matches on top of your head. So if you fell, you know, nodded, it fell on the floor. So you would know, and everyone else would know, so it'd be embarrassment value. It was amazing when I tried that, only 2 or 3 days, and that matchbox wasn't falling off my head at all. It stayed on. I thought, amazing, I've conquered sloth and torpor. And then one of the monks, come over here, Baba Wong, sir. I've been watching you. I know why the matchbox doesn't fall off, because before you used to nod this way. Now you nod this way. That's true. No, the psychology was you were still nodding, but you nodded in such a way to keep the matchbox off. So it was, that was really frustrating. You know, there you were trying to sort of be a good monk, and you're struggling, and it was just so painful, you could never do anything right. And sometimes, though, you did really screw up your mind and put forth immense effort. You really struggled. I really am going to watch the breath. This is important. And you break through sloth and torpor. The mind would clear. And my goodness, you'd be so restless. You couldn't stop thinking. So I calmed the thoughts down. I fell asleep again. And to me, I think some of you recognize what I'm talking about. That you were like a pendulum, always going to the extremes of sleepiness or restlessness. You calm the restlessness, you go back to sleep. So if you fight the sleepiness and you're restless, you can never find that middle point, the sweet spot, where you're awake but peaceful. And I realized that was because I was fighting. The effort was causing that. And you heard people like Ajahn Chah, let it go, be still, be content. You know, it's empty, it's not you, it's not your problem, what's the matter? But it takes a long time to trust a teacher, even the one you respect, simply because it goes against everything you've ever been taught. And so it took a long time to trust it, but eventually it was just frustration. I had no other place to go except trust the teacher. Nothing else worked. So as a last resort, you trust the teacher. But the last resort. So I trusted him and just let it go. And I was sleeping. The amazing thing happens. The sleepiness, you're just sleeping, not doing anything. And you just wake up. The sleepiness disappears. And you're awake and alert. But peaceful. No restlessness. Beautiful. Just nice. And you can watch the breath without effort. And that's wonderful to see that happen. All it is you're creating the causes for mindfulness to increase in its strength. Effort, striving, takes up energy. Huge energy. If you haven't got much energy because you've just woken up and you're tired, isn't it the most illogical thing to do? To waste what little energy you have in fighting? When you're letting things be, you're conserving energy. You're just allowing the energy, the small amount you have, to build up and build up until it's great enough that sloth and torpor disappears. That's all dullness is, a low energy. If you've got low energy, you don't need to waste energy. Be still, make it be peaceful, be kind, be gentle. Then it goes all by itself. And it starts to get you on this path through that hedge maze. This wonderful path. And you just let it go. You just let things be and be content. And you watch all these amazing stages just come to you. Because once you get past the sloth and torpor, you go into the middle of it. You don't change it. It just vanishes. And there you have usually what's left is this beautiful silence and present moment awareness. Again, present moment awareness. All the past and all the future. You know, it's a total waste of time. And where is the present moment? Again, it's in the center of everything. The silence is in the center of my words. There's always a space between the words. It's what the words encompass. You know, describe, you know, drawing a circle around a thing. That's what a word is. So it defines the thing. You know, and the man's circle. And what's inside is what we mean by a man. You know, the lid of my cup circle. And what's inside is the meaning of this. So really all the words, they just describe something. They circumscribe it. And it's what's inside, it's a silent bit, that's the meaning. So after a while, you don't do anything. There's nothing to say anymore. You're silent. Now, you already got into some nice meditation. For many people, if you can just be silent in the moment, you have a wonderful time. So much rest. How much stress you have thinking and having to work things out, and sometimes you can think this way and that way 1 minute, 1 hour, and you still don't find a solution. How many times have you wasted all night thinking about an important thing you have to figure out? I remember this when I was a kid. I hated going to the dentist. Now, if you're afraid of dentists these days, You know, so when I was growing up, sort of, you know, 50 years ago, they were much worse. So, you know, this was, you know, very close to the sort of things which happened in Guantanamo Bay when you went to the dentist when I was young. Well, I'm exaggerating, but I was really terrified of the dentist. And on this one day, I'd maybe been about 7 or 8 years of age or something around that age, my mother told me that I had to go to the dentist the following morning. And of course I cried, "Mummy, don't send me to dentist. I don't want to go to dentist." "Darling, you have to go to the dentist." "But I don't want to." "But you have to. That dentist is nasty." "No, he's kind." "No, he's not. You don't sit in the chair." And so my mother just wouldn't give in. So that night, you know, I really worried. As in, as a kid, worrying about what's going to happen in the morning. In the morning, of course, you try it again. "Mummy, please don't send me to the dentist. My teeth are okay, look." "No, darling, you have to go." So then I decided to use my secret weapon. "Mummy, you don't love me." But no matter what I said or did, my mother dragged me to that dentist. And it was so painful just for that night and going there. And when we finally arrived at the dentist surgery, the appointment had been cancelled. What an experience that was. All that worry, all that argument, all that thinking. And what happened? Cancelled. I didn't need to go anyway. So look, just how often does that happen? That's the first time that happened in life that I can remember. How many times you worried and thought and lost sleep over something and it never happened anyway? So, here in this retreat, just what happens, we just go silent. There's nothing to think about. Isn't that wonderful? Nothing to say, nothing to do, nothing to think about. Some people think that's boring, but for me, that silence is so amazing. It's a sacred silence. Much more profound than anything I can say. So when you get into the silence, what do you do next? Long question, stupid, don't say anything. Your whole job is to like guard the mind, to make sure it doesn't interfere with this natural process. That's your job. That's where effort comes in. That's what striving is. Striving not to interfere. Striving to let go. Striving to renounce control. Striving to abandon desire and craving and wanting. That's what we're supposed to strive. It's like putting a guard around your mind. And any time like a want comes in, bang, got you. Any time sort of, you know, a thought comes in, bomb, squashed you. I'm not being violent like that, but you know, I'm a man. That's just how we describe things. So you just let go of all these things. So what happens next? When I started meditating, I would watch the breath. These days, I don't watch the breath at all. I just sit there in the silence. The next thing I know about is the breath. The breath comes to me. And sometimes I wonder, how does that happen? Because I never looked for the breath, but it came. And again, that's the insight practice is not just samatha, this is insight too. The insight comes after meditation. Did that happen? How did that happen? You investigate, you have the experience, strange, weird experiences, and you use that to investigate. It became quite clear to me what happens, and this is an important part of the meditation practice. When you sit down with your eyes closed, nothing moves in your sense of sight. When nothing moves in your sense of sight, your sense of sight turns off. It stops. Click. That's one sense has been dealt with. If you sit absolutely still, you're not moving. After a while, your arm disappears. Why does it disappear? Because nothing's going on there. It's not moving. When everything is still, click, it turns off. Because our brain is wired only to notice things which change. Things which are constant, it's not important for the brain. So it just clicks off. So your body disappears. As long as people are banging, crashing, speaking, or answering their mobile phone. You know, in the Singapore retreat, somebody actually answered their mobile phone in there. We couldn't believe it. Amazing, just. So no mobile phones, turn them off. No beepers, nothing. Because then, as long as the sound is silent, or if it's not even silent, but it's constant, sound turns off. And that's already happened to most of you during the meditation, but maybe you've not noticed it. Because you don't notice a sudden, now there's sound, now there's not. You just afterwards think, my goodness, I wasn't hearing anything for a long time. Why? Because sound is constant, and then it turns off. So when I'm letting go of the past and the future and letting go of thinking, I'm so still that all of my senses turn off. Sight turned off, smell, taste turned off, the ears turned off, the body turned off. But actually the body doesn't turn off all in one. Legs disappear, because nothing is moving, the arms disappear, the head disappears, but something is left which is moving. My breath is moving. And I realize that's why I become aware of the breath. Because it's the only thing left which is moving in my body. Everything else is still. And then I understood why the Buddha taught the breath meditation. It's not something you do, but something which happens. It's a natural path. A natural path means nothing to do with you, whether you choose to do it or you don't choose to do it. This is natural what happens. As you're not doing anything, you're sitting still, the body is still, most of it disappears, and one thing which is still moving is your breath, going up and down, which is why you're aware of it. And if that happens, if instead of trying to watch the breath, you allow the breath to come to you at the right time, it's always a very nice breath. Simply because it comes at the right time when it wants to come. It's a difference if you have like natural foods, you know, grown in your garden, or you get these foods which are grown by some company where they put this chemical on and that chemical and they force it so it gets to the market at the time the prices are the highest. Those never taste as sweet. I remember some of the most delicious fruit I ever ate was in, we were 6 years in the monk, I was in just Kaukio, just out of Chonburi. And this was the army used to use that as a place for exercise. It was really thick jungle. And so, you know, we're in the middle of the jungle, and apparently just one of the novices up there just, you know, wandered around and found this ancient plantation, which had been abandoned for I don't know how many years. And because it was an ancient plantation, they had like mangoes and bananas and papaya there. Because it was natural, no one had been looking after it, just grown in the jungle. That was the most sweetest and juiciest fruit I've ever eaten in my life. Because it was just in the forest, it was totally natural. Human beings haven't looked after that for decades. And that's just like my breath. It's totally natural. It's delicious. I force it. And it loses that taste, that flavour. So when I just let the breath come to me, oh, it's always just really nice. Because it's really nice, it's very easy to watch. You boys, doesn't matter how old you are, if there's two women walking down the street, which one do you notice? The beautiful one. The same way you always notice the delicious things. They're much easier to watch. This is actually just our nature. So if the breath comes up and it's very beautiful, it's easy to watch. You don't have to force yourself. So this is actually where the breath becomes so easy. So we get this awareness of the breath. Simply because that's the only thing we have to watch. Everything else is settled down. And what happens next is the breath becomes very refined, very soft. Whatever you watch, if you're peaceful, it starts to settle down. Just like the waves on the lake get less and less and less. Just so the breath gets more and more smooth. And what happens is important to understand this. that, yes, you know the in-breath and the out-breath at first, and then, you know, as the mindfulness increases, you know, the very beginning of the in-breath, just all the way along to the end of the in-breath, you see the gaps between the breaths, these beautiful pauses where nothing is happening. And then the out-breath begins, and that sort of reaches its peak and then fade away. Not just in-out, but this constant flow of thing which we call breath, in and out. And what happens next is, you know, you can't tell much difference between the beginning and the end of a breath, or the in and the out breath. It's just breath feeling, that's all. Because, you know, when you really think about it, the breath going in past your nostrils, or wherever it's washed, or breath going out, it's all the same feeling, just breath going past your skin, or your mucous membranes inside the nose. Look, if the wind is passing your face, it always feels the same whether it's coming from the west or the east. And that's actually what happens with the nose as well. It's just a feeling of breath. And after a while, the perception of in and out disappears. It's just breath. You're just knowing the breath. So if you think, oh, I've lost the breath because I don't know whether it's going in or going out, you're doing fine. This is what's meant to happen. Which is why I'm talking this talk today. So when these things do happen to you, you don't think, oh, something has gone wrong. I don't know whether I'm going in or going out. I don't know where I am. You're with the breath. That's enough. So leave it alone. Let the process happen. Because the breath is in the middle of this silence, this sustained attention, continuous awareness of the breath is in the breath, and this just even breath is in the in and out breath. It's always in. It happens naturally. And as you're just watching the breath, it gets more and more beautiful. Remember what I said, is the stillness gets deeper and deeper, the mindfulness gets stronger, it gets more subtle, and you get more energy in the sense of more happiness. So whatever you watch, even if it's a piece of shit in the toilet, that's beautiful. Imagine what it's like just watching your breath. It's just so delightful. And that is the tipping point of the meditation, as I keep saying. Tipping because now this breath is just so nice. You're just watching this breath, having a great old time. This is why where you can't wander off anymore. You can't sort of thoughts can't really bother you because you're having too good a time. Even sounds, just shut up, I'm enjoying the breath. You don't even pay too much attention to them because you're having too much joy. Joy replaces any need for striving. When you're enjoying something, you don't need to put forth effort anymore. The mind naturally will stay with what it enjoys. So you can let go totally now. You're enjoying yourself with the breath. This very subtle breath. You don't need effort. Why do you need effort when you're having such a good time? Yeah, people need to have effort to go to work. But do you really have effort to, say, watch the cricket on TV? Do you have to strive to sit there when Sri Lanka are playing Australia? No, I enjoy this. There's no striving at all. So you can sit there for hours on end. If it's your favourite movie, I saw coming back from Nolamara, I think on the weekend, that Harry Potter, the next movie, is out. And those who like Harry Potter, you won't need to strive and put forth effort to go to the cinema. You go there naturally. And when you're in the seat, you don't need to say, I must pay attention, I mustn't wander, I mustn't get sloth and torpor, and I mustn't go thinking about other things when I'm watching Harry Potter. It's natural, because if you enjoy it, you have samadhi. You have attention. So this is what happens with the breath. It gets so nice, it just stays with you. And then, because it's so still and so nice and so beautiful, that's where you get to the stage where you can meditate for long periods of time. You just sit there having a great time. And the measure is this. Even at this stage of the delightful breath, it's so delightful that somebody rings the bell for breakfast. And you've got this choice, breakfast or meditation. And meditation wins. You'd rather just stay with this breath and miss breakfast. And that shows you the sort of happiness you're getting in meditation. You just breakfast is just, it just can't sort of grab you anymore, you're having too good a time. This is just the beginning, because then you don't know when the breath disappears, but after a while you say, there's no breath anymore. And people get very concerned, I've lost the breath, that means that I am not meditating anymore, I've lost it. No, you haven't. This is part of nature. Just like the body disappears, now the breath disappears. Why? Because nothing much has been happening with the breath. It's been constant. And that which is constant and still disappears from awareness. The brain turns it off. And that is the last part of your body that's gone. You can't feel the head, your torso, your arms, your leg. The breath is gone. Now you've got to that stage we call kaya prasadi, the tranquility of the body. It's gone. So all you're left with is the sixth sense, your mind. And this is the first time you start getting into the mental experiences of just mind, your body and your five senses have disappeared. Sometimes people experience the blackness first of all. Doesn't matter, just stay with that. That's just the way you perceive it. Things are going to happen soon. Don't disturb it. You're just going in. Sometimes people experience the sheet of light. You know, just not a round limiter, but just everything is bright. Great. Don't worry about it. Just stay there. Enjoy it. Sometimes it's just the delight is left when the breath disappears. Great. Just enjoy it. Because all the time you don't do anything. Don't spoil it. Things are happening. You're developing peace, contentment. So when those days happen, people say, what should I do? Do what you've always been doing all along. Nothing. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. Have the same attitude to that state as you have to your sloth and torpor. Let it be. It will develop. And this is what happens, just if it gets very delightful. And whether it's a sheet of light or whether it's just a delight, so a sheet of light or just a very happy feeling, after a while a beautiful light comes up. Ooh. Sometimes it's to the left, sometimes it's to the right, sometimes it comes up very quickly and shocks you and you just stuff up and just, wow, what was that? And you have to go right back again. Some years ago, someone reminded me in interview time, I gave the simile of snakes and ladders. That was a game I played as a kid, you know, with the dice. And if your counter landed on a ladder, you went up. You know, you went up many squares. But if it went to the head of a snake, you went down again. And at those games, there was always the 99th square. 100 was when you win. The 99th square was always the longest snake. You always go back down to the beginning again. If those remember that snakes and ladders game as kids. And that's just like, you get very, very peaceful. Limiters come up. You've landed on this 99th square. And you go, ah! And you go right down to the very beginning again. And that really sucks. You know, you got so close and, so you've got to do it all over again. So, when these things happen, just don't change course. Keep on letting go, being peaceful. This is natural. And you'll find these beautiful lights come up. Just leave them alone. They're just doing their thing. So, none of my business. It's just nature, that's all. And these lights come up and eventually they stabilize themselves. If they're to the left, they will center themselves. And you don't have to worry what color they are or what shape they are. You know, it's amazing that if we had a possibility, we'd take a photograph of them. That's how we like to keep all this stuff. We want to describe them to ourselves, we investigate them, and we just mess up the meditation. Leave them alone, just enjoy them. So these beautiful lights come up. And if you really know how to let go, they will stay with you. And that's the test of that particular stage of meditation. What on earth can I do to keep those beautiful lights there? Because so often they come up, they disappear. They don't last for most of you. Why? Because you can't leave anything alone. As soon as, well, okay, you can leave the breath alone, but limiters, yeah, they're my limiters, so I've got to hold on to them. I've got to sort of mess around with them, you know, because I've got them now. I'm gonna do my thing to control it for the rest of the meditation. Leave them alone. The more you interfere, the quicker they disappear. If you leave them, they stay and get brighter and brighter and brighter. Brighter than watching the sun. More joy than sexual intercourse. More power than you've ever felt. Ooh, this is nice. And that's where you have a wonderful time. And that's when afterwards, ooh, that was good. Are you interested? Of course you are. As it just comes to you. And usually it comes to you, you know, as a surprise, first of all. One of the advantages of being a Westerner, because we've got this terrible lack of self-esteem. So even though I say this, many of you Westerners think, well, yeah, maybe Ajahn Brahm, if you're born like that, you know, you can get these limiters, but ordinary people like me can't. Excellent. Because that means you've got no expectations. And when it does come, wow, was that me? And so many people in interviews, this is to save me a lot of time in interviews, you say, I saw this light, was it a limiter? 99% of the time, it was a limiter. People say, no, it couldn't have been. It came too early. No, if it's a light, it's a limiter. And so, no, somebody must have been, it must have been the sun coming up. Look, we've arranged it so it's a cloudy day the next couple of days, so it can't be the sun. Okay? And there's no sort of cars here, there's no headlights, there's not a flashlight in your face. It's a limiter, a real one. Well done, enjoy. Don't have such lack of self-esteem and think, oh, it can't be because it's me and I'm hopeless, I can't do these things. Yeah, it's happening. And what is that limiter? Just a reflection of your citta. For those of you who want to know what citta means, what we usually say is mind. That's it. As the Buddha said, the mind is radiant. It's prabhasara when the defilements aren't around. And the Buddha wasn't just being metaphysical. He was just describing this particular experience in meditation. All you have in front of you is the prabhasara citta. It's obvious, it's a citta, it's your mind, and my God, it's radiant. It's beautiful. And that's how you see it. It's an incredible light, radiating, powerful. Now, for any of you who think, oh, I can't stand this, it's just too bright. It's a mental image. It's got nothing to do with your eyes. You are not going to go blind. So don't be afraid. No matter how brilliant it is, it's no worries at all to your mind. No matter how joyful it is, there's no worry to you either. You won't explode, as I said the other day, because sometimes that's what it's like. You know, I'm saying that to make sure you don't get afraid. You get more joy, more bliss than you've ever experienced, by far. You think, wow, I can't take any more of this. Yes, you can. Go for it. You deserve it. And when that happens, because you're enjoying yourself to the max, at the right time, not when you want to, when the right time happens, you just go dive right into that. Again, you go into the next stage, which is in the middle of the nimittas. And those are the jhanas. These beautiful states. And what are you aware of in the jhanas? Bliss. So the light is what you're basically aware of in the nimitta stage. Your perception of this thing like being like an image of sight. In the jhanas, it's just bliss. The light's disappeared. And in its place is incredible stillness, peace, bliss, love, whatever you call it. Being at one with the universe. All these ways that people describe it, but you're having a great old time. And you realize just what is possible for this human being. When the Buddha starts to describe all these different levels of existence, you get some idea what the Buddha meant. Because you've been through some of those levels in the path of meditation. You understand what this mind actually is. You've been with it, with the nimitta. Understand its power and its strength. You're getting a huge amount of insights from this. and the real insights which you get, which do change the way you perceive life. Because basically you are kicking your perceptions out of the ballpark. Everything you ever thought was possible, well, everything you thought was impossible, now you have right in front of you. These are life-changing experiences because they are so weird, they're so extraordinary. But there they are, you're experiencing them. And to become enlightened, you can't rely upon your normal set of data, what everybody else in this world experiences, sees, senses. That's not enough. The Buddha needed the extra data from the jhanas to blow away his misconceptions about who he was, the nature of will, the nature of consciousness, the nature of this world. You need the biggest kick up your backside to get rid of delusion. What is that kick? Samadhi. The big stillnesses, the blisses, the peace. And it's because of those experiences and knowing just what they will give you, that is why I teach meditation. That's why I teach in this particular way. That's why I built this meditation retreat center. That's why I put en-suites in every room. Just so you can bliss out, get into those deep meditations and see the Dhamma. That's what it's all about. So, what do you have to do? Nothing. It's all done for you. Or as Ajahn Chah would say, some of the most amazing teachings came from this great master. And they're great teachings because at the time you don't understand them. They are weird. But then when you actually experience some of these states, you realize that that person had been there as well. And he understood from experience. These are not things which you read in suttas. This is just how people from the time of the Buddha and since have described these experiences each in their own ways and created these amazing similes which just capture the essence in a way which ordinary people can sort of understand. And that was when he described his monastery. In the first few months I was there, he said, Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, is like the mango orchard. And he said the mango trees were planted by the Buddha. And the mango trees are mature now. And he said the mango trees are just dripping with ripe mangoes. There's thousands of them on the trees and they're just so ripe and juicy. And he said, you monks these days are so lucky. You don't have to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't have to throw a stick up to get the mango to fall down. All you monks have to do is hold out your hand and a mango will fall into it. You're so lucky. And that was Ajahn Chah's simile. You know, it's amazing that he said that simile the first few months and then he never said it again, as far as I recall. It was just that wonderful simile which came into his mind and then he went on to other things. What an accurate simile that was. It was rubbish to me because, yeah, you know, it's mango trees. You put your hand out in front of a mango tree. Come on, fall. It will never fall. If it does fall, it falls over there, never into your hand. Maybe onto your head. Squash. But what he was obviously meaning was those mango trees were the Dhamma. And every fruit, you know, is the jhanas, the enlightenments, few meaning, once returning, non-returning, arahat. All those amazing things which people want to meditate for. Nimittas, jhanas, enlightenment. You don't climb the tree. You don't throw sticks up. You don't shake the tree. Stop shaking your tree. That means that mangoes never fall down. Open the door of your heart. Just let it be. Be content. Then a mango falls right into the center of your hand. That's so sweet. That's how you meditate. Stop climbing the tree. Stop shaking your mind. Come on, meditate. Just open, release, and the mango, jhana, nimittas, whatever you want, will fall into your hand. And that's accurate, that's so true. So that's your job. Open your hand and be still. And that's the talk, the overview, the stages of meditation and how they work. So it's not, do this, have you got to that stage? Okay, well done, tick, now go on to stage two. No. That's not how we meditate. So, any questions about this morning's talk, about the stages of meditation? Yeah.
You once talked about asking questions of your previous life, and you talked about
Your
baby carriage.
Yeah.
How do you ask questions about your previous life without disturbing your baby?
What you do is the end of the meditation. Enjoy the meditation, first of all. So this is just like the sweet which comes after the main course. So you know, when you have lunch today, don't go for the sweet first of all. I just want the ice cream today. Forget about the curry or anything else. No, just have the main course first of all. Have the deep meditations. And as you're coming out, you know, you had a great meditation. Oh, this is really, very nice. Then, towards the end, just as a little bit of extra, ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? That's how you do it. Just ask the question. Just, what's my earliest memory? It doesn't really disturb too much. It's just a very, very short interruption, instruction to the mind. And if your mind is ready, it will come up almost immediately. If it doesn't come after 1 or 2 seconds, you're wasting your time. So don't come. Come on, earliest memory. Come on. You get a thought. Is that it? No, it comes easily, very clear. No doubt at all, without any struggle. That's an amazing thing. So just, when you're really peaceful, what's my earliest memory? It'll surprise you, it'll shock you. Just how easy and clear it is. But it has to be the right time. Again, because of craving, we think, oh, maybe it's not jhana yet, but I'm sure this is good enough. What's my earliest memory? No, come on, do it properly. Don't rush. And then it's great because many, many people, especially in Western countries, they think, yeah, they like Buddhism, they like the psychology, but this reincarnation business, I think, is unscientific. It is scientific. There's evidence out there. But for people to experience it for themselves, that obviously takes away all doubt. And you can do that. And people have done that. It's not that difficult. Just get nice meditation and ask, what is my earliest memory? See who you were before. Who was it? Are you interested? Some people say, I don't want to know. Because they've got this insight into them, they weren't such a good person, so maybe I don't want to know. No, don't be afraid, it's interesting. Does that answer the question? Okay. Any other questions before we break? Okay, so in the middle of the retreat now, you've had all the instructions, you got all of the inspiration, you got a full belly, it's cool, it's brilliant situation, all the factors are coming together, all you need to do is nothing. Very good. Okay, so enjoy the day.